Hello, this is Frankly Speaking, an informational exchange of problems and issues of relevance to people everywhere. Today's program addresses the subject of the effects of alcoholism. I'm Stephanie Hopkins for George Mason University. But before I introduce my panelists, I'd like for you to meet Mrs. X. Mrs. X is a recovering alcoholic.
I'm Mrs. X, and I have been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 4.5 years, and before that time, my life had become unmanageable. My husband was seeking help for me prior to my knowledge, and it was necessary for me to be really backed up against the wall before I saw that I had to come do something about my drinking.
To elaborate on the subject, my other panelist is Mr. Ollie Morris, an alcoholism specialist and also a recovering alcoholic. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about that. What is the definition of a recovering alcoholic? So many people use the word reformed, and I'm told you object to that word. Why?
I'd like first to go back to the definition of an alcoholic. So many people think an alcoholic is a skid row bum. And that is less than 5% of the alcoholics in this country today. There are as many definitions of alcoholics and alcoholism as there are people talking about it. But to me, an alcoholic is a person who, once he takes a drink, cannot guarantee his behavior. And that's all. And that takes in approximately 1 of every 8 adults in this country who drinks today. And we don't see those people running around as Skid Row bums. We see them as housewives, corporation presidents, as doctors, as lawyers, as presidents and presidents' wives. All over the country we see them, but they do not show as alcoholics as we normally have thought in the past.
So there is no ethnic barrier, no financial barrier, no special neighborhood. It crosses all lines.
Alcoholism is the most equal opportunity disease known to man.
You started out by defining alcoholism. Now let's talk about recovering versus the word reform.
Okay, the word reform connotes generally people who have been in bad trouble, such as people who have been paper hangers or forgery or murderers or otherwise. And that, when those people are reformed in the connotation we normally think, they have seen the light, if you will, and have been born again. And we do not feel that way about alcoholics at all. We feel that alcoholics have merely been able to bring their disease under control and retain complete control. It is almost as it is with diabetes. We do not cure diabetes, but we do keep it under control for the rest of our lives, and alcoholism is the same way.
Mrs. X, how long have you had your alcoholic problem under control?
4.5 years.
Mm-hmm. You talked about your husband actually seeking help before you were aware of that. Do you feel as though normally it takes someone from the outside to make the initial push or to make the person aware that they are really an alcoholic?
I think in many cases this is true, but around the tables of AA, I have often heard of people who recognize the problem and walked into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting cold.
Even though it may have affected a loved one, in many instances, possibly the loved one is even afraid to address the problem themselves.
Yes, in many cases, not particularly in my husband's case, but I have heard in many cases where the spouse or other people, loved ones, just will not recognize the problem, will not face up to it.
In many, many cases, the majority of the cases, I might even say, the spouse can seek help before the alcoholic themselves seek help. Because one of the key things of alcoholism is the term denial. We always deny there is a problem. And in the family concept of the disease of alcoholism, the non-alcoholic members of the family can become just as sick as the alcoholic themselves, and many times sicker. When they seek help, they in turn learn to change their attitudes and their ways of living, which forces a change of the alcoholic. For every change, there must be a reaction.
Ollie, explain for me, how do you know that you're an alcoholic? Are there 7 symptoms that you can look at, like cancer? I mean, how can a person who's listening to this program actually admit to themselves that they are, or a member of their family or friend is actually an alcoholic?
I would have to go back to the very simple definition I gave at the very start. When a person cannot guarantee his behavior after a drink, if they cannot guarantee it every time they take a drink, then they had better look to their whole card and make sure that they are not alcoholic, because the majority of those people are alcoholics in hiding, that they have denied themselves, even though it is a subconscious denial. It may not be a conscious denial. But when they start getting into trouble and can connect their trouble to the times they were drinking, then it is the time to start checking to see if they're not alcoholic. There is no blood test. There is no mental test. And incidentally, it is often said, it is the only disease known to man that must be self-diagnosed.
I'd like to address the current argument that is used by the younger generation. My parents constantly have a cocktail after work to relieve the tension, or either at their weekend parties, they always serve drinks, or on Sunday mornings when they have brunch, they have Bloody Marys. And as a result, what's the difference between them having a drink or myself smoking a J or a joint or marijuana or however you'd like to describe it? Is there a difference?
I do not feel that there's any difference at all. I feel that they are both potentially addictive. Now, it is known that at this stage of the game, it is known that marijuana is not physically addictive, but it is also known that it is mentally addictive. So our people can become mentally and emotionally addicted to it. And there is no real difference as far as I personally am concerned. When I was drinking and my son would talk about marijuana, I became very, very upset.
Parents become horrified at the fact of marijuana, but yet they will run back to the kitchen or to the bar or whatever and take two or three cocktails and feel as though the two aren't comparable.
And that's the dichotomy of the whole thing, because we are telling them to not take a drug while we are taking into our bodies one of the most dangerous drugs known to men. Dangerous because it sneaks up on us so easily.
You had a comment, Mrs. X.
Well, alcohol is socially acceptable and legally acceptable. Drugs per se, marijuana, heroin, so forth, are not acceptable legally.
So possibly if we were in a different era when alcohol was prohibited, then maybe the public would view them as being comparable. However, since you can go to your local ABC store and purchase it over the counter and the government has put their legalized stamp on it, it makes it okay according to the public. I mentioned the youth, and that's my major concern. I saw a program recently where a five-year-old stood in front of the television camera and said, "My name is John, for instance. I'm 5 years old and I'm an alcoholic." How often is that happening?
Far more often than we know, because these children are able to sip out of their parents' martinis, and I have known a number of cases like this at the 6, 7, 8, 9 year age brackets, are able to sip out of their mother or dad's martinis, and the mother and dad do not realize this is a tiny body, a tiny liver, and a tiny brain that is sipping out of this, the same thing that they do at their aged, if you will, bodies, and the fact that they are used to these things, they are accustomed to taking this heavy drug in. But this tiny body, the destruction in the liver is horrible at that time. And it's more prevalent than people really realize.
Do parents realize when their teenager or their youngster is starting to dabble into their own personal stock?
Not until it's too late.
That's about right. Not until it's too late. What happens so often is our children, and I'm seeing this in a categorical way, our children in... And I'd like to state at this time that alcoholism is not a disease of the ghettos. It is a disease primarily of the affluent. And the more affluent the parent, the more likely they are to have the alcohol around the place that the children can get to. But the thing for the youngsters these days is pot primarily. And they can get their pot, and it can twist their mind just enough to want a little bit more of something else. At that time, they can then go to some wine, some beer, some scotch, some whatever they drink, whatever that's available in their parents' house, or the 7-Eleven, or wherever they go to get it, and they can put it on top of the pot. So you have the potentiation, you have the two drugs together, the THC from the pot, and you have the alcohol from the booze, whatever booze they're drinking. The synergism between these two is so great, the potentiation of one drug for another, that it helps to destroy the tolerance for any drugs within their bodies. This, again, we're talking about young brains and young livers, and there's where the two parts of the body that are destroyed more rapidly than anything else. So when this potentiation hits and when this synergism takes effect within them, they can destroy certain tolerances within the human body, so that we're getting what we now call instant alcoholics. And that's where our 5 to 9 to 11-year-olds are becoming alcoholics at this age now, which means one thing simply, that never again, as long as they live, can they safely drink.
This is all very frightening to me because I grew up in a very Christian home where alcohol was never even allowed, okay? So you weren't even exposed to it until you went away to college or either at high school, some of the local, not the crowd that you would hang around with, but the other group might possibly be sitting out in the car drinking a beer or whatever. But again, we're talking about youngsters who should be enjoying their youth and actually acting as children who are taking on the problems of adults. And I'm wondering, at that point in their life, how do they actually cope? Because we're saying it's a problem for an adult to cope with. So how does a youngster deal with that?
They are not able to deal with it in the total way. They do succumb to this disease very early and very rapidly. And we can go into our schools today and we can see this happening. And I'd like to turn this over at this time and let you talk about that particular phase of it.
Well, the alcoholism and the drug addiction in school has risen. Right now I'm working with a teenage doubly addicted drug alcohol problem. His start came from the medicine chest at home. And, of course, television would help this along because of the advertising of the drugs. And this well-stocked medicine chest was a source of drug addiction for this teenager with whom I am now working. I have, in school itself, I have tried to face counselors, guidance counselors, with the idea that students who are on drugs need professional counseling from an alcoholism board of some kind, a counselor of some kind. But it is regarded more as a moral issue, as a matter of discipline, which of course it is not. Alcoholism is a disease just like anything else, any other disease. And this is where you hit your snag. You have, just like your nurses and your physicians, your school counselors, your principals have to be educated in the field of alcoholism.
Can someone who has not been an alcoholic, who has not been around an alcoholic, who has not actually experienced it by either direct or indirect contact, counsel someone adequately?
They can counsel them and from the mental standpoint of the thing, but they cannot counsel them from the addictive standpoint. I do know some non-alcoholic counselors who are quite good. But without exception, those people who are quite good in the field are those who have alcoholism in the family itself and have been affected by the disease of alcoholism.
So there was some type of contact.
There is contact.
Unfortunately, our time is up. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public affairs program produced by George Mason University. Production coordinator, Pat Ping. I'm Stephanie Hopkins for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you. Hello, this is Frankly Speaking, an informational exchange of problems and issues of relevance to people everywhere. I'm Stephanie Hopkins for George Mason University. Alcoholism is a major problem in America. Because of its impact, this is our second segment on the subject. We're talking with Mrs. X, a recovering alcoholic, and Mr. Ollie Morris, an alcoholism specialist. Mr. Morris is also a recovering alcoholic. Let's talk about drinking problems at home. I'm rather concerned about the closet drinker, be it an alcoholic that is a youth or possibly an adult.
The American man seems to have the ability to hide the fact that he does have a problem at home, and he goes on and lets this person at home die. These people are not moral degenerates. These people are people who have been hooked on drugs, and I have to use the term in the broadest sense of the word, because alcohol is one of the most dangerous drugs known to man. But they have been hooked on drugs inadvertently the majority of the time. Tranquilizers coming into our medical field have been one of the finest things that ever happened. However, they have been misused by many of our medical people. They've been misused by many of our patients. And when the doctor gives tranquilizers to a woman, he gives them to her for a particular purpose. Well, so often the woman finds that these will do things that she did not really expect to have done. And as I mentioned potentiation before, and synergism between drugs, often they will take their Valium or Librium or one of the other tranquilizing drugs
and then follow it with a cocktail.
Feel much better, then follow it with a cocktail because they are feeling better and it's going to make them feel that much better. So again, we have the potentiation. This does not go in mathematical progression. It goes in squared progression. In other words, 2 times 2 squared is 2, and they add the other one, 2 squared is 2. Bring it down to 4. 4 squared is 8. 8 squared is 64. So you don't have 2 and 2 is 4. You get 2 and 2 is 64, is the potentiation, the final outcome of your drugs in this. And this is the destructive effect on liver and brain both. So we have many, many people who are hooked at home, who do not even know they are alcoholics, do not even know they are hooked on other drugs, who continue to drink and drink heavier and heavier because they are getting sicker and sicker. And many of these people will be working 3 and 4 doctors to get their tranquilizing drugs and come back by the ABC store or wherever they get their booze and get their booze, take it home, take their tranquilizers and wash them down with their booze. And your potentiation goes greater and greater.
Does a person normally learn to drink at home, at school, at work, in a social setting?
For me, I learned to drink at home. And I found, when I was about, I think it was about 31. I was 31. And I had a particularly rough trip across town 4 times a day. And I used to come home from that and find that if I just took a nice little swig of whiskey that calmed my nerves and got me settled down. And, of course, as the years went by, I increased the intake. And so I think in listening around the tables at AA, a great many women are home drinkers.
And is that because of boredom?
No. Well, no, I don't think it. Well, on my part, it was not because of boredom. On my part, it was because... Well, I wanted to hide it. I knew something was wrong and I shouldn't be drinking that way. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't doing it from boredom. I was doing it because I thought I was relaxing myself and easing the tensions and because it felt good.
You needed a drink,
per se. I needed a drink, per se, yes.
Okay. There is the housewife, though, whose husband is literally married to his work, mm-hmm. Who only has her children as her source of interaction. By the time the husband gets home, he's too tired to do anything other than eat dinner, watch a little television, and possibly go to bed. The children have been screaming all day, or if they're in school, she's had all day before they get home to, quote, get her drink or relax or take her tranquilizer. Is this a common syndrome?
Well, that's a very common syndrome, yes, because, and they use the woman in a case like this uses the alcohol for relief. Relief from the tension that's built up over the period of time and the terrible disappointments that most of them are brought up to believe that just this man on this charging white horse is going to come along and take him out of this whole thing, and suddenly she finds herself saddled with a half dozen children and in effect no husband, but the guy comes in and eats supper and goes to bed, and she is bored to death. And suddenly she finds some relief from this boredom, and the little relief continues to add up to more and more and more. Because we develop a tolerance to this drug, so it takes more and more and more of the drug for us all the time.
Would it help that woman, or even that man, let's not be partial here, to possibly find something to fill their hours with, some type of activity?
I wish I knew the answer to that, but I've never heard of the answer to that. I really haven't, because they still have X amount of child caring to do, X amount of homemaking to do, X amount of this, and the first thing you know, the day's gone, and they're tired. And no matter how ill they feel, they may have bad colds, they may have the flu, these jobs have to continue to be done. So this is where they seek relief.
Ollie, you might bring out here, I think, the difference between a woman who will drink to relax and it never increases. What is the difference between this kind of a woman or a man and the one that goes, that keeps increasing and increasing the amounts of alcohol to relax? What is the difference there?
Well, some people become addicted to the drug, and some people never become addicted to it. Some people can continue the rest of their lives. And that's why I stated in the other program that one of every eight adults who drinks becomes an alcoholic. Those other seven can drink safely as long as they live. But I'd like to toss this in. Many of us have the difficulty of having been raised in a family where alcohol was absolutely prohibited. It was a mortal sin and all these things. But when we got out and found this relief, we found the relaxation. We found that it was the social lubricant that we've been looking for. Then we began to use a little more and a little more. And if we have that potential for alcoholism, which was my case, I was potentially an alcoholic. I believe I was one waiting to happen, and that's all. Then I developed a fantastic tolerance for the drug, and nobody ever knew I was drinking. And it took a great amount of drug for me to begin to feel where many people would take one drink and they were higher than a pine tree.
Is the only way to do it cold turkey? In other words, can an alcoholic just take one drink?
An alcoholic can never take a drink. And never take a drink safely. People ask me, don't you think you could drink again? Yes. I could drink most people under the table. But I don't have any more sobering ups left. I've had my last one.
You had a comment, Mrs. X?
No, I was just agreeing with what Ollie said. You absolutely, if you are an alcoholic or a drug addict, you never can take alcohol or any kind of drugs again. It's fatal. I mean, for me, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I know it. I know I cannot drink again. And if I do, my disease is progressive, and I will just pick up where I left off and go down the tube very, very quickly.
What does alcoholism do to the family?
It literally destroys the family. It destroys the family because all continuity of the family is shot. We begin to center around that one individual or that one disease, and the rest of the family goes down the drain.
I've heard of stories where all of a sudden wallets become missing, items of value in the house become missing because the individual is seeking an avenue to cover their habit, which could be alcoholic. It could be an alcoholic habit, or it could be a drug habit. But they resort to all means to get the end result. Is that true?
If it's not readily available, if the funds are not available, the alcoholic, when they become desperate enough, will go to any lengths to get those funds. If it comes to selling the tea service or the silverware or the wife's diamond ring or the husband's stick pin or whatever it may be, when they become desperate enough for the drink, they will do these things to get the drink.
Let's talk a little bit about how you cure the drinking. What's the first step?
First, I'd like to toss in a word. There is no such thing as a cure for alcoholism. We can become recovering alcoholics. It can be arrested as diabetes or as tuberculosis. But there is no cure, because cure connotes that when a person is cured, they can go back and do it again. And we know that an alcoholic can never drink again safely. So we arrest the disease of alcoholism.
And what's the first step of recovering?
Don't drink. That's number one step.
The alcoholic must recognize his or her problem and admit it. That is the first and most important step for an alcoholic.
And then once they decide, or they know that they've got the problem and they've decided that they want to arrest the problem, should they go for some type of professional help?
Without exception, we recommend that they go for professional help. We do not necessarily recommend that professional help be psychiatric or medical. We have found in the past that only the same number of alcoholics need psychiatric help as there are non-alcoholic people, 1 in every 10 who need psychiatric help of some type or other. The fellowship that has done the greatest amount of good that has ever been brought forth in this world is Alcoholics Anonymous. And of every 100 people that go to AA, 50 of them get off of alcohol immediately and never drink again. Of the 50 that go out there and try it again, 25 of them eventually will make it back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, 75 of every 100 will get sober and stay sober. The other 25 die. Whereas of those people who go to the doctors, the ministers, the priests, the psychiatrists, and so forth, 5% of them, by these people's own admission, the professionals, 5% of them can be gotten off of alcohol and kept off of alcohol. And I like the 75% figure a lot better.
Can you give us a phone number or, if not a telephone number, how they can look it up?
It's in the telephone book. It's in the telephone book under Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the Fellowship of Al-Anon, it's under Al-Anon Family Groups. They took the first 2 letters of Alcoholics, the first 4 of Anonymous, put them together for Al-Anon, the Al-Anon Family Groups.
And that's for the person who is not the alcoholic.
That's for the one who is not the alcoholic. However, they can also get information from their own how to get a hold of AA for friends, neighbors, family, whatever it might be, from either of these places.
What can a friend or a family member do for the alcoholic? What would be their greatest need?
In my particular case, my husband helped me in that he did research on this, waiting for the time that I would admit that I had a problem. And he did this, he read an article in the Fort Belvoir newspaper. And in this way, he became acquainted with Mr. Morris, and who was head of alcohol at Fort Belvoir. And in this way, when I was ready to admit it, all he had to do was turn to Mr. Morris and find out what I had to do.
So he laid all of the groundwork.
He laid all of the groundwork for me before, and that's what I strongly advise for people with alcoholics.
You really needed the love then. Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate my wife had done the same thing. I was very fortunate. The thing we can do for the alcoholic is love them enough to want to save their life. And when we do that, we're going to find out how to go about it. And that's the main thing. Love them enough to help save their life.
Unfortunately, our time is up. I'd like to thank our guests for being here. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public affairs program produced by George Mason University. I'm Stephanie Hopkins for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.